This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Here is a clip from earlier this month on Jon Stewart's Daily Show.
Across America, new and innovative ways to alleviate homelessness are being introduced, like banning the homeless because of body odor, fining them for sleeping outdoors, and arresting them for sitting down. But Salt Lake City, Utah has taken the next step by removing the homeless from their streets altogether.
Sir, have you seen any homeless people?
Nope.
Have you seen a single person living in a cardboard box?
No, sorry.
Where the hell did they put everybody?
Salt Lake City's Housing First program to manage homelessness has received some national recognition recently. In fact, Utah has led the nation in reducing chronic homelessness, which is defined as long-term or repeated homelessness. From 2005 to 2014, chronic homelessness dropped from 17% to 4% among Utah's homeless population. It's also reduced costs to the state from roughly $20,000 to only $8,000 a year per homeless individual. The model is challenging long-standing practices for helping the homeless. Recently, advocates and service providers working on homeless issues for Utah spoke at the University of Utah. They also came to plug the state's Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust account, which taxpayers can choose to donate to in their income taxes for services to help Utahns become self-sufficient. Former mayor of Salt Lake City, Palmer DePaulis, served as the moderator. He will introduce the panel. This discussion was recorded on January 15th.
So I want to thank you again and welcome you. And just let me introduce our panelists. And I'm going to mention all of their names first, and then I want to say just a word about each one before they speak. So first of all, here right on my immediate left is Matt Minkovich. He's the executive director of the Road Home in Salt Lake City, a service provider. Next to him is Elizabeth Bueller. She is the homeless services coordinator for Salt Lake City, under Mayor Ralph Becker. And then next to her is Pamela Atkinson, whom you probably all recognize. And it's her fund that we're talking about. She is named for this. Next to Pamela is Tamara Kohler. She is the director of the State Community Services Office, which is under Housing and Community Development in the Department of Workforce Services in the state of Utah. And then finally, Joseph Hardy. He will be speaking to us about his journey, and he is a client of the Road Home. So we have a really terrific panel today. But first, I want to turn to Pamela Atkinson, because this is about not only the issue of homelessness, but about, I don't know if I can say this enough, the check off on the tax form that will help us out. But I want to just say, just briefly, I know Pamela doesn't like me to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. Most of you know her, and I think most of the people in the state know her, for the endless work that she does for homelessness. And she is not only well known, but it is her passion and her work, the time she spends, her enthusiasm. I don't think we could have a better representative for our community on this issue for so many years and hopefully for so many years to come. I don't know what we would do without her, but her passion and her enthusiasm is an inspiration for all of us. So Pamela, could you start? And also, if you want to talk about the tax form, we can walk through that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Palmer. And thank you all for taking time out of your busy schedules to be here. I'm hoping that by the end of our time here, for those of you who haven't had much to do with homeless individuals and homeless families, you might have a little more understanding of who they are. They're very much like us. They're people with dreams, hopes. They're people with goals. Just to illustrate, yesterday I was at Sunrise Metro. That is a permanent supportive housing. Has 100 studio apartments, and living in these studio apartments are 100 men and all women who were chronically homeless, which meant they could have been homeless for a year. They could have been homeless, like a couple of my friends in there were homeless for 17 years and one for 21 years before they decided to come in. And that's what we're all about, is ending chronically homeless for so many people who have so many needs. The reason I was over there yesterday afternoon is one of our good friends, Melvin, had died. He was a delightful man. He took great pride in keeping up the memorial garden that's out in the back of the building. He endeared himself to us. Periodically, he'd go back on a drinking binge. But even then, he was never rude or nasty. He was such a delightful man, and we loved him. And yesterday, as we celebrated his life, we had a lot of laughter and we had a lot of tears. But it was like anybody's celebration of anybody's life that people have loved. And we told stories about our interactions with him. And as I sat there with the tears flowing in company with other residents of Sunrise and also other residents from elsewhere who'd know Melvin and their case managers, and listened to the depth of caring and commitment and compassion to people that we've helped off the streets. It's a team effort. I appreciate the kudos you gave me, Palmer, but I am part of a team. If you look at the acronym TEAM, and Governor Herbert loves this one, it stands for Together Everyone Achieves More. And I'll be quite blunt with you. There are some things that I do on my own that nobody else but the good Lord and I know about. But much of what I do is as a team member with Matt's team, Liz's team, with people like Tamara from the state and our friend Joseph, from whom we've learned so much of what he's gone through. You see, you can be part of the team by checking off on this form. It's called the Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund. It used to be called the State Homeless Trust Fund. And then Speaker Marty Stevens some years ago had what he thought was a brilliant idea. And so he got a bill through the House and the Senate and changed the name. But this is a fund that's administered by the state that people have to apply for to get a grant to deliver the services that we're giving to people such as I described about Melvin and the 99 other people in the permanent supportive housing, in the road home, in emergency services. You see, we're all of the opinion that everyone can make a difference. It isn't just one person. If I get a call for help and I can't help that particular person because of the particular problem, I know who to call, whether they're in the nonprofit world, whether in the city or the state or what have you. And let me assure you, it is easy to help. It is easy to make a difference. I was out on Christmas Day with some friends delivering hot roast beef meals to some of our campers who could not come in. If you remember, it was snowing that day. It was cold. And we saw some young people, very much your age, three of them, who were camping out. And they were wondering how they were going to get a meal because there's no transportation. And then we arrived in the van with these hot meals. But we gave them clean, dry socks. Their socks were soaking. And we gave them blankets. And then, for once, I actually had some ponchos. But this isn't something that I bought. The ponchos and the blankets came to me via the LDS Church humanitarian. I had called them up and said, I need blankets in my car. Do you have any ponchos? They didn't have any ponchos, but they ordered some from Texas and got them in. So on this Christmas Day, we were able to give them out to people, young people in some instances, who were camping out and who needed that warmth. But you know what mattered to those people with whom we were working on Christmas Day? it wasn't only the gift. It was that somebody cared enough to donate that. It's that caring that is behind the donation. So when you donate $2 on the state income tax form, it means that you cared enough to help make a difference in somebody's life. Even a pair of socks can help somebody who has blisters that are infected, but no socks and boots that rub. It's the small things that make a difference. It's the smile, that's free. It's the touch, that's free. It's the listening ear. It's the arm around you. They all make a difference. And let me reiterate what I said at the beginning. So many of our homeless friends are very much like we are. And when they feel cared about, when people donate to help them, that's when their self-esteem starts to get a little bigger. That's when they think, yes, I do have some self-worth. These people care about me. That's when they go the extra mile. That's when they try a little harder. So I invite you, if you're not already, to become part of our large team. And remember that together, everyone achieves more. And in this instance, it's helping to change people's lives and helping them take a step out of homelessness, the first step to becoming self-sufficient.
That's Pamela Atkinson, longtime advocate for the homeless and refugees in Utah. Atkinson spoke recently at the University of Utah, along with other advocates and service providers, about their work in helping to reduce chronic homelessness in Utah. Stick around, we'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just joining us, a couple weeks back, the Hinckley Institute hosted a panel on homelessness. The discussion was moderated by former mayor of Salt Lake City and public servant Palmer DePaulis.
I'd like to now introduce Matt Minkovich to you. Matt is the executive director, as I indicated earlier, of the Road Home. He's been providing services, shelter services, and other services for people in Salt Lake for some time now. He's well known. He has a terrific team. Speaking of teams, some of them are here today in the audience. But I just want to give Matt a few minutes to talk about his role on the team.
Thank you, Palmer. And is this working? Is it so, okay? I want to be careful that I don't get too loud, because sometimes in passion you can become loud. But things are so much different now for you than they were for me. I graduated from the University of Utah, so as I walk through these halls, I went to so many classes here at Osh, and it smells the same. It's timeless in that regard. But it was so different. I had a basic educational opportunity grant that not only paid my tuition, it was helpful. I got like a $50 bill back after I paid my tuition, and that covered my books for sure. These are one of those stories that the old folks tell you, and a loaf of bread used to cost a nickel, and all that kind of stuff. I used to listen to the old folks tell me those kind of things, and places in Ogden that used to be pastures, and now they're full of homes, and things change, and of course that is the way that life moves. But sometimes things change in a seismic manner. And I think about when I got my first W-2 form. I was 14 years old. I actually started working when I was 13 in 1974, but the boss was paying me cash, and so I didn't get a W-2 until I turned 14 that subsequent year. I was a busboy in a restaurant, and it turned out to be a good time for me to go to work. It was just kind of a fun job for spending loot, but that happened to be the same time that my father was laid off. And from the very plant that closed down that had brought us to Ogden from Maine all the way across the United States. I was the 10th child, and we traveled by station wagon across the United States to Ogden, Utah. My mom didn't even know where it was. Ogden, Utah? What country is that? But But we came out, and we've been here ever since. The reason I bring this up is because when my father was laid off, he had a mortgage to pay. That mortgage was $132. He was making just about that per week. And my mother was also working. So 25% of his bring home pay was paying a mortgage. And it was stable housing through which a family of 10 had a wonderful existence. And a little bit of money I spent on an extra gallon of milk or a cheap loaf of bread or two that I'd bring home was actually helping out. And we lived tightly, but never on the verge of homelessness. And if you were to look at what you're paying for tuition, the loans with which you may be burdened going forward, it's different for you. So too is it different for anyone paying a mortgage out there. And if they were to lose one wage of the wages that were coming in to pay that mortgage or pay that rent, life's different. There has been a seismic shift. I worked in Denver, Colorado, and I found that I could live on $5 an hour. That was a good paying job. I paid $150 for a studio apartment. I had money left over to pay tuition for the school I attended there, and living was tight, but I was able to make it. There were scores of apartments right by the Capitol in downtown Denver that were going for the same rate, $150, $175. I grabbed a good one for $150 that was better than some of the ones at $175. Those are all gone. But there were a lot of single men in those units in those days. Scores of them. Ogden City had a lot of storefronts, little mom and pop businesses, but on top of those businesses were housing units, and that's where some of Ogden's people lived. Single men, single women. They might have a job washing dishes, but they could afford to live on a dishwasher's wage. It's changed. The very same person who, by virtue of time, a calendar, who grows up washing dishes now, is probably going to be sequestered to the homeless system in America. And it doesn't need to be that way. There are 90% of the people that come into our services in need of shelter who we hardly get to know because they stay for such a short period of time. And then they move on their way. They have a brief episode of homelessness. 90% of the 7,082 people we served last year in this category of very brief episodic homelessness, on they go through their difficult journey with a little bit of help from us. On the other side of that, there's about 10% of those 7,082 people that are in a different situation. And for a variety of different reasons, and yes, substance abuse, mental health, behavioral issues may be a part of it. They may be a part of it. They may or may not. These individuals are relegated to the homeless shelters of America. And they live there because there's nowhere else to go. So as much as we exist at the Road Home to provide shelter, to get people out of the cold, because you know what, tonight there are going to be 1,100 people coming to us, and that trumps everything. We've got to get everyone in, even if it means putting a mat on the floor, which is not the best accommodation, and providing an extra blanket. I'll use it as a pillow and as a blanket. Do whatever we possibly can to get you in out of the cold. Last night, I had an opportunity to talk with one of the police officers who was talking to a gentleman who was freezing. And as circumstance would have it, I had just gotten out of a conversation with a wonderful individual, Jerry Nichols. If you're listening right now, a shout out to you. He was an architect. He's the architect who designed the shelter originally. He came down because he had a beautiful Carhartt warm coat. He said, I just wanted to give it to you, Matt, because it's going to find the person who needs it. I was like, okay, Jerry, who do I know? I don't know, but I had to stay at work just a little later because of that. So I walked out on the street with a coat because there was going to be someone out there who needed it. That's just the way it's written. And I saw Officer Sam and met Officer Tyler. How's it going? It's like, oh, we just busted a little dealer and got him off the street, and we're having a little conversation about this gentleman. I looked over at the gentleman, and he was in a all-cotton hoodie. On that damp night, he was shivering. You know where the coat went. He was making a step. He went out to those officers and said, "Today's the day I need to become clean. I need to shake this." And the cops were there, and we were there. I put a coat on him. He was speaking Spanish. I'm not fluent in Spanish, although my brothers and sisters are. I'm not. But the officer was, and he walked him into our shelter. And that's where Volunteers of America will step in with their expertise and help this gentleman, whose name I did not get, make his brave journey on recovery, that maybe we'll have a few stumbles along the way. And we can judge him and say, he shouldn't do drugs. Nobody should do drugs, right? That's an ancient affliction. It goes back to the Middle East for ages. It's been in the opium dens in China for centuries, millennia. And it's part of our existence today. And our judgment is expensive. We put him in jail, it's $80, $90 a night, just to turn him back out onto the street to suffer some more. We can get angry and we can put him back in there. Then we can say, three strikes and you're out. Send him down to the prison. Let's just erase ourselves of any responsibility for what this guy is about. What's going on? It's an easy answer. And then it's like the jail fills up and the prison fills up. It's like, God, this is costing us a lot of money. And shelters might be a cheap answer in the short term. They're expensive in the long term. So as much as it's important for us to get that guy in off the street, and that's what we live for and breathe for, we want to reverse this whole thing. And we want to create housing. So shelters like the one that we're currently running, that I'd take a bullet for right now, can disappear. Because we can serve 2/3 of those 7,000 people who come to us. On any given night, we only need about 80 shelter beds to do that. It's that other third that's taken up hundreds of beds nightly, and they have nowhere else to go, and we can create that somewhere else to go. And in your lifetime, you can talk to your children about homeless shelters, and they'll say, what are those? And it might be, oh, it's that little tiny place over there, but it won't be that great big place right here. We can do that. We need to do that. I've gone on too long, but thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Matt. We really appreciate your insights, and especially putting a face on what really we're dealing with. I'd like to turn to Tamara Kohler next. Director of State Community Services Office, because she is the one who helps direct where this money goes. And of course, she's also involved as a member of the team as well, doing things in our struggle to provide services for the homeless. But I'd like to give her a little bit of time to talk to you about her position.
Thank you, Palmer. I have a unique position as a state employee to be surrounded by some of the most impressive people I've ever met. And not a lot of times can you say that in government, that you have that great opportunity. But with it comes an incredible responsibility. Our role and our office's role is to allocate funding that comes to us and to pass it through to those incredible community partners that serve, house, care for, take the blankets out, assess the needs, bandage the foots that are frostbitten, and meet those frontline needs, and begin to assess what someone's son, daughter, spouse, who may have fallen away a little bit from our societal needs, that needs this extra help. We have a unique fund. This tax campaign is a kickoff to a fund that you can personally say, I want this money to go in that direction. And I can tell you from state government, that doesn't happen that often. This fund passes directly through to those service providers. And it's used, as Palmer had said, in a number of different ways. But one of the critical things that it allows us to do is something we call leveraging funds as well. We are able to bring in more funds into the state, federal funds that we can leverage. So for every dollar that is donated that comes into this fund, we can leverage $5 towards putting those funds to meeting those needs. I have often wondered, I'm kind of a numbers person, we have to be at the state. We count things, we assess them, we measure them, we talk about performance, but we also understand the human part of it. But what we could do if everyone gave $5 on this tax campaign, if I had 100,000 individuals in the state of Utah that would donate $5, Matt, how many people could we house with 500,000? And I think that it is that simple. As Pamela said, you may not have the opportunity to go out and serve someone. And you may wonder, as you see people who are homeless, how do I help? And I can give you the promise that this fund passes directly to those service providers, that they're able to do that, and that we have great confidence in the work that they do. And they actually do more with such little funding. I oversee one of the smaller pots of funding in my department, but I have to tell you, at the end of the day, we have a hard time leaving our work and going home. We have a hard time turning off the lights because we know how important this work is and how important it is to make sure that those funds are being used in a good way. We have a stewardship for it, but I can promise you that those funds are used in a way that anyone would be proud of. I have never had a question on how the stewardship we have over these funds that I've ever been concerned about. Because I know that we've got to have shelter. And I know that I have to have skilled, compassionate case managers. And I know that I have to have housing. And I know that these individuals greatly appreciate it and have the opportunity to have a step up. And many, 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 as Matt said, it's a small amount. It's a very small amount. But we need to support those efforts. Before I had the opportunity to work for the state, I would see people and think, how can I help? What can I do? And I am so impressed with the position the state has taken in creating a fund that individuals can choose to put money into, that you can say, I want this money to go in this direction. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to work with such great partners. But I'm also grateful for the trust and the stewardship of the people's money. I know that it comes from your paychecks. It comes from my children's paychecks. It comes from my own. And I am grateful for the opportunity to serve in such a way to make sure that we make those needs possible to be taken care of in a charitable and a respectful way, and to have the opportunity to make a change. Not very often can you say, I know that I'm making a change, and I know that this makes an impact in people's lives. And we greatly appreciate everyone that takes that opportunity to check the box. It's a little extra work. You got to know where to find it. But we're grateful for those opportunities. And I'm grateful to speak to it because I think that it's kind of the bright light in the challenge of what we do. What's interesting about this funding is it's no respecter of the barriers that maybe have caused someone to fall into homelessness. It is so flexible that I can meet the needs in St. George. I can meet the needs in Cedar City. I can deal with those in Moab. I can serve people in Uinta Basin, in Brigham City, in Ogden, in Salt Lake. And it is custom fit for the needs that community has. And it is no respecter of those barriers. Mental health, substance abuse, financial challenges, whatever it may be. And that's rare anymore that we can pass funding through that is only a respecter of need and not the barrier that may have caused it. So thank you, Palmer.
Thank you very much. Tamara may be all about numbers, but I can tell you she has a wonderful heart. So, and now I'd like to turn a few minutes over to Elizabeth Bueller, who is here representing the city. She's the Homeless Services Coordinator, and I have just recently been working with Elizabeth, and I have to tell you she is very knowledgeable. And many of you that may have some questions, you'll find that she has a lot of answers. So let me turn time over to Elizabeth.
Thank you. So what I'd really like to talk about is what Salt Lake City is trying to do to support the work that's done with the Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund and some other initiatives we're doing. Up until maybe now, about a year and a half ago, Salt Lake City, besides working on another project with Pamela separate from the Homeless Trust Fund, our host program, and that goes through her separate foundation. And besides just passing through federal money and a little bit of our own general funding, most of the times when we were dealing with homeless services, unfortunately, it was mostly through negative externalities. Our police department, our fire department, our streets and parks, it was mostly about things that had happened, and we were taking it a negative approach to things. But what we decided about a year and a half ago under Mayor Becker's leadership and city council support was really to find out how can Salt Lake City itself participate and help support our service providers further and support the state's work and especially Pamela's work. And how can we just, what is our role? How can we improve homeless services in Salt Lake City? So after a lot of work, we've really identified six items, what we call our six-point strategy plan to improve homeless services. And we sort of identified just six things that if we could get them done quickly would really help Matt in his role and our other service providers like Catholic Community Services and Volunteers of America Utah, 4th Street Clinic, and many, many others. So, and they range all over the place to public safety, to we now have 81 officers that are dedicated to downtown and Pioneer Park neighborhoods that actually are using the techniques we learned through our host program with our three officers, and they're really using community policing techniques. Now, as Matt mentioned, his situation last night, our officers, instead of immediately arresting someone, they learn their stories, and hopefully they're getting them into the shelter instead of having to take them down to jail. We're trying to increase the community events in Pioneer Park neighborhoods so they're open to all residents, and that's include residents of the shelter at Rescue Mission and elsewhere. We're working with Catholic Community Services and Downtown Alliance to improve the services at the Wiegand Day Center so people, when they visit the Wiegand Center, that they have more opportunities for services, and we're doing a lot of things. But there are two I really want to touch on. One is on housing, because housing first, it's been mentioned before, that's really everyone's in game. That's our goal, is to have enough housing out there that you don't have someone staying on the streets for longer than a year, that our veterans have a very short time experiencing homelessness. That is our end game. And then we're also working with Matt and our other service providers, specifically around Pioneer Park, to look at the services and how can we help them improve those services, improve that service delivery. So housing. We started two initiatives. One, it's called House 20, and the name really isn't important, but really the idea is that to get the 20 most vulnerable folks that are around Rio Grande and 500 West and 2nd South off the streets as quickly as possible and get them into housing, to get them into the services that they need. And that's moving forward very well. And the second housing, and that's the biggest one, is building 300 new permanent supportive housing units in Salt Lake. Unfortunately, the last big project like this was Palmer Court that opened about 5.5 years ago. We haven't had any big projects that have opened since then. So Salt Lake City is dedicating to build 300 new units. I think we're about 8 to 10 weeks out from announcing that the first phase of that, which I'm really excited about because we all know it. Housing first, that's success, that's what's going to get us there. While we're working on this, we're also working on a new, what we're calling a homeless services site evaluation commission. We've talked a lot about the neighborhood around Rio Grande and Pioneer Park, and those facilities, and correct me if I'm wrong, the Road Home opened in 1988.
Yes, that's correct. December of 1988.
December 1988. And all of our facilities down there are older, now 30, 20 years old. And unfortunately, because of city's own zoning laws, even if Matt did want to change his services, expand his facility, he would be blocked by the city. So we're really looking at how can we support, if they choose to do that, how can we support them in that? So we're doing that as well. But again, the thing we're most proud of is the 300 new housing units. And that's actually part of a larger effort. Matt was talking about how people, unfortunately, they're starting, that space is getting narrower, where you can hanging on to where you actually drop into homelessness. So this is actually part of a larger initiative that we're doing, where 5,000 new affordable housing units throughout Salt Lake City, everywhere from up on the bench to Central City to West. We're trying to build these units. So everyone, if you want to live in Salt Lake City, you can find an affordable place to live.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. A couple weeks ago, on January 15th, advocates and service providers working on homeless issues for Utah spoke at the University of Utah. Mike Minkovich is executive director of the Road Home in downtown Salt Lake City. Pamela Atkinson is a longtime advocate for the homeless and refugees in Utah. Elizabeth Bueller is the Homeless Services Coordinator for Salt Lake City. And Tamara Kohler is director of the State Community Services Office. And Joseph Hardy is a former homeless client of the Road Home. The panel was moderated by former mayor of Salt Lake City, Palmer DePaulis.
Good, thank you. And now I want to turn some time to Joseph Hardy, to maybe share a little bit about his journey through this whole process. He's a client of Matt's shelter, the Road Home. Joseph, do you want to take a couple minutes?
Yes. I didn't really prepare what I was going to say today. However, the first thing I want to ask everybody here is, how many people set an alarm clock this morning to get up to be here today by a show of hands? Now, what if you didn't have an alarm clock to set to be here? Do you think that you would make your first appointment today on time? Probably not. What if you took the bed you slept in away from you while you're sleeping on the floor then? How many people got up and got in the shower before they came? Now, what if you didn't have the shower to get in? It makes things a little harder. You know, you went to your closet, picked out some clean clothes, maybe some socks, put them on. What if you didn't have those to put on? Boy, life's really difficult, huh? What if you take the freaking house you're in away from you? That's really hard. What you have there, concrete. Well, I've been there. First of all, let me tell you, I'm a native Utahan. I was born in St. George, Utah. A lot of people think that the majority of the homeless issues are from people that are coming in from out of state, things like that. No, I was born here. I've had a long journey. I think my first experience of homelessness was at age 5, when my mother and father divorced. And I started traveling around a lot. I mean, I was in 4-5 elementary schools in a year. I really didn't have the chance to get an education. I remember times that, and I had 4 brothers and sisters. Actually, I have a total of 28 brothers and sisters, but 4 with my mother. And when my mother and father separated, I stayed with my mother. Well, as 4 children, I remember a time up in North Dakota. We were in the backseat of a car sleeping, and it was winter. It was cold. We cuddled together in the backseat of that car with a blanket. You know, just because the warmth of each other kept us warm. And I remember that my mother would feed us bologna sandwiches. You know, when the bologna actually ran out, my mother fed us what she called ketchup sandwiches. That's 2 pieces of bread with a little ketchup between them. You know, and that's what my life was like as a child. The whole time that I was growing up, bouncing around, moving around, there was good times that we had, you know, shelter, we had food, and then there were times that, actually, I remember a time in Arkansas. We spent the whole summer camping out in tents by a river. You know, we'd go bathe in the river, go swimming for a bath. You know, there was a lot of good memories and a lot of bad memories. A lot of hard times. I mean, at age 5, was my first experience with homelessness. But over the years, I mean, it's affected me. Now, some of the ways that it affects me, like I'm housing first now. And it's like I get food in my house and I'm just like, I hoard it. Because I know what it was like out there on the streets being hungry. I know what it's like to sleep on concrete. You know, you drive past the road home down there and you look in front of the road home and you see people laying out there on the sidewalk. And they sleep there all night long till the cops make a move. Okay? There's some of those people, they have mental health issues to where they can't even walk inside to get the help. Me, I actually have mental health issues. I've been diagnosed bipolar or schizoaffective disorder, bipolar type 1. There's been times that my mental health, I was having so much paranoia for me to even walk into a public store. I couldn't do it, let alone walk in a shelter and get a bed for the night. You know, I've been in and out of that shelter down there. I think the first time that I come to Salt Lake was 1990. And in and out of that shelter numerous times. I remember one time that I was in the medical dorm at the shelter. And there's this guy in the bunk next to me. And he'd just come in from the university hospital. And he had no leg from here down. Well, actually, it was just a little below his knee. And half his foot was gone. It was all bandaged up. I'm like, what happened? Because while I was drinking, I fell asleep. And he said his leg and his foot was hanging out from underneath the blanket. Well, he got frostbite, and he cut his leg off. And half his foot. You know, it's really something to think about. I mean, I've seen people out there, like, there was a friend of mine, he was an Indian, he had a drinking problem. And he couldn't make it back to the shelter during the cold months, and he actually froze to death because he'd been drinking and couldn't make it back. You know, I remember that night that guy come in, the next day, they had some med students come down from the university just like to give a little time to the 4th Street Clinic, and they're changing his bandages. And I remember they took his bandage off of his foot. And when they took his bandage off, it looked like somebody just lasered his foot straight across, and there's no skin over it. And that happened because that man didn't have appropriate shelter to go to. Whether he was drinking, whether he was doing drugs, whether he was sober, it didn't matter. If that man had a warm place to be that night, he'd still have a leg, still have a foot. You know, you probably ask yourself why people end up homeless. Well, every situation or every person's case is different. Me, I ended up homeless because we moved around a lot. There was no stability. My mother did the best with what she had with 4 children. And a little bit of child support she got from my dad and state assistant. Sure, the resources that were available back in 1970 compared to what the resources are today are like night and day. But my whole life has been one, either homeless, or two, incarcerated. And to be straight with everybody here, I served 18 years, 3 months in the jails and prisons, and that's only in the state of Utah. And at age 15, I started using drugs because I couldn't cope with how I was feeling inside about my childhood because it was very abusive. Okay, a lot of instability, neglect. And I've been now struggling with that addiction for approximately 30 years. I've been struggling with my mental illness. And, you know, it's like even being in jail and prison was better than being out there in the streets. I mean, that wasn't, you know, locking me up was not the problem, it was the solution. Desperate people do desperate things. When people are desperate, like out there in the street, they tend to do desperate things to survive. And unless you've ever been there, you really won't understand. Sure, I can tell you. I mean, in the homeless community that I've lived in the majority of my life, I mean, I see people that's there because their mental health, they just can't function. And it seems like our government right now, with Social Security, they just make it hard for us. I mean, I'm still right now, I've been in Housing First for a year. I've been fighting to get my Social Security, and they're just, in other words, I go through my application, they deny me. I go through my appeal, they deny me. Now I'm waiting for an administrative law judge. I even have an attorney that says you will get it. I'm like, well, why won't I get it now? They say, because you have a history of substance abuse. Well, that doesn't change the fact I have disabilities. You know, in 1995, I caught hepatitis B and C because I'm an intravenous drug user. A week after I got hepatitis B and C, you know what I did? I went down where the Gateway Mall is built today. It used to be the UP office building and rail yards down there. And they actually have a main track that goes between Ogden and cuts around and goes to Vegas. And the reason I know where it goes is I used to hop it to get to Las Vegas or to get to Sacramento. Well, I went down there that night, and I got really high, and I jumped between two train cars in the attempt to end my human existence. Okay, today I sit here. Can you see the scars on my leg? That's what I have after that. You don't really know what people are feeling or what they're going through unless you actually walk in their shoes. And there's a lot of people out there that need a lot of help. And even if they're a polysubstance abuser, they're doing it for a reason. They can't cope with how they're feeling inside. Or why they're drinking. That's all I got to say.
Joseph, thank you very much. We appreciate your story and where you've been, and it's great to know you're in Housing First now, and it's at least a hopeful future. So I just want to thank all the panelists for being here. Thank you, Joseph, as well. I want to thank the Hinckley Institute and the Binion Center for their support of this annual effort. And I want to remind everyone to please use the checkoff. If everyone did $2, we would have a fantastic amount of resource to share. And if you can't, as you heard, if you can't, you can just send something to the State Tax Commission and make sure that it says it goes to the Pamela Atkinson Trust Fund. So that's what we are about in terms of trying to end homelessness today in our program. And I want to thank all of you that were here to hear us and participate. And we hope we have resonated in some way with you as you go forward with your student life and on into your careers. So thank you very, very much. And thanks to the panel.
thank you for listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour today. This program is brought to you by the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah and KCBW. You can also hear this program again and all of our other past programs on KCPW's website. You can also follow this program on Twitter at KCPWHinckley and listen to us on iTunes. And join us every Wednesday morning from 10 to 11 a.m. to hear more engaging forums and speakers on political and legal issues affecting Utah. I'm Ross Chambliss, and this is KCBW.